namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa buddham dhammam sangham nasami. Not used to holding the mic. Let's see how we go. It's interesting coming into a new shrine to learning how to drive a different car. This is a nice car, isn't it? I think I was here about 13, 15 years ago. And the roof line of this is just so elegant, isn't it? It just got the roof just right. And that was, all these beams were made by hand, all glued up by hand. Right? They set pegs out on the concrete, and then they bent them. You notice they're laminated, right? So that's 2-inch lamination or something. And they just bent them, glued them, bent them, glued them. So they made them right here by hand. So it's handcrafted. So we're very fortunate to be here, to be. I met Ajahn Kanti Paulo in Thailand and New Zealand. And if you think about all the practice that has come through here, and the people who have worked very hard to make, and continue to work very hard to make this place practice, place of practice, we're very privileged. And so we're practicing on the shoulders of a lot of selfless service. Because to build this thing by hand, so far from a hardware store, it's a considerable achievement. And it's lasting. How many years has it been here? 20 years?
32
years. Very impressive. So that it's always good to bring up into consciousness all the heart qualities which make this practice so much more beautiful. Because sometimes the work of meditation can be hard work. If you're going through something difficult, it can be a real hard slog, but there's just the beauty of generosity, bringing that, making that consciousness, the beauty of devotion, thinking of the Buddha, and his own personal work, and his enlightenment, and then that he actually had the compassion to share this teaching for 45 years, and then you just imagine how many beings for 2600 years have been sitting on cushions and building monasteries and offering dana, and it's really, it's quite an extraordinary thing. And quite often we don't make that conscious. We kind of know it as a sort of historical fact, but oftentimes we don't make it conscious. But when you make that conscious, if you do that, you make it conscious, and you bow to the Buddha, say, and you kind of look at the Buddha image and say, wow, what a being, what a marvelous being, and what good fortune we have to be in that lineage of practice. And that brings a quality to the heart, which I think is very important. It's a joyous quality, it's a quality of gratitude, it's a quality of aspiration, in doing the work. And that is a great uplift. In your practice, at least I find that. So we have these days together in this most silent of places. It's very silent. It's probably the most isolated monastery I know. We have some isolated monasteries in Canada, but this is really stunning. So we have this beautiful environment. Silent environment. We have 3 days and then an evening and a morning together, I think. That's correct. It's a short period of time, but also it's significant because now we have a chance to really put away our distractions and really dedicate our time to just being present, being centered, being mindful, and doing things beautifully. And that's one of the things that Lompo Cha, one of the many things he taught us in Thailand, was to in our ordinary activities to try to bring beauty into our lives. So one of the memories I have of Ajahn Chah was setting up the dining hall for a meal, and I was pushing spittoons out of my foot. And you don't do that in Thailand, that's gross. Only a gross Westerner would do that. And the way he instructed me, he didn't say, "You dumb Westerner." He said, "That's not beautiful. It's not beautiful." It's such a lovely way to teach me. No, that's true. It's not beautiful. So the way he taught mindfulness was to bring a sense of beauty into all activity, into the way you bow, into the way you wash your bowl, into the way you eat your meal, into the way you do walking meditation, cleaning your putti, and so on and so forth. And so in the ordinary, he was encouraging us to be present, to do things well. I was just at Wat Pho Phong, Lopa Chah's monastery, just a month ago, I think. And just the level of craft among the monks and nuns is very impressive. Just the bold stance they make, and really, really lovely to see. So that kind of emphasis on constant mindfulness, constant awareness, not as control. That's one of the things I misunderstood when I began Buddhism, was the sort of sense of trying to control everything. So mindfulness became this terrible effort of being very present and being very controlled, and it was a miserable way to actually live my life. But actually seeing that the mindfulness is a lovely way to be present, to know what you're doing, to do things well, had the more the tone of care in it, the tone of kindness and the tone of gentleness and such like. And so that's the basic thing that we always do on a retreat. We try to be mindful, try to be careful in what we do. And one of the things I think on this retreat is, as Ajahn was saying, we try to cultivate the practice of noble silence. So that's a beautiful thing to do for yourself and for each other. And just to spend a few days where you don't have to talk and self-identify. You don't have to talk about your family and your dog and what kind of cornflakes you like to eat or whatever we talk about. So you can just be very nones. Very nice. You don't have to be a personality. You just do what they ask you to do, kind of thing. And so there's a great sense of, it's a kind of interesting combination of both community and privacy. We do both. So by community, we try to come together, chant together, do the work together, and help each other in the way we practice. But within that, we're very silent and aware of how our hearts are feeling and how our minds are reacting. And that's a kind of unique combination of community and privacy. But it's not the privacy of selfishness. The privacy of selfishness is like if you're sitting meditating and the person next to you has a cold and they're sniffling and sneezing and coughing and you think, I wanted to get out of here, I'm trying to meditate. That's the privacy of selfishness. Leave me alone, I'm trying to get enlightened. Which is a kind of miserable way to live your life. So we always joke about that. We say, I'm doing metta practice, leave me alone. And loving kindness turned out for you today. And so that's a sort of selfish way. So like selfless service is like how can I help you do this retreat? And yet how can I not intrude upon you? Let you get on with your karma, I'll get on with my own karma. And one of the ways we do that, like in the monastery, is just like come to a meeting. Come to the meeting on time and do the work quietly, and do the work gently, and set a good pattern. And we were just talking about some of our beloved senior monks, and one monk, how he's always there, always the morning meetings, always the evening meetings, and he's so inspiring in sharing his practice in that way. So do try to practice noble silence then, and remember if you need to say something, that there are people in the monastery who are available for that. Or if you have any questions, if you could write them down, I'm happy to take questions. But I think I'll not get into too much dialogue because that just stirs the mind up. So if you have a question, leave me a note and I'll try to answer. But I might not answer. That's the question. So during this time, most of you have a practice that you've been working on. I'll make suggestions about meditation, but if you have something that really works well for you, then just keep honing it, make it better, make it stronger. Many ways to practice. On this kind of retreat, Ajahn Kimavara didn't tell me what the title was, so he set me a challenging task, selfless service. And I think I overheard him speaking about my experience with my mother recently. So for most of the last decade, I've been living with my mother in her condo, which in itself is very interesting, because I've only lived in forest monasteries most of the 30 years before that. And so it's been a kind of totally different social environment, but the practice is the same, the practice of mindfulness. And to be truthful, the two best things I've done in my life is to ordain as a monk and take care of my mom. By far, those are the two best things. And the interesting, being with my mom, one of the things I realized is that when a person is elderly, it's hard for them to serve someone else. It's one of the insights I had with my mother, because she was 96 when she died, so her faculties were, her mind was strong, but she didn't have anyone she could give to. And she kept trying to buy me things. I've got a good collection of socks now. How many socks did one guy have? But just when you think about it, when there is someone in your life that you can serve and you can help, that's actually quite a gift, isn't it? It's kind of an odd way of looking at it, that if I have someone in my life that I can care for, because what it does, it brings out of me the very, very best. Compassion, generosity, and self-sacrifice. These are very, very lovely qualities of the human heart. Those open-hearted qualities, that I think are a very important foundation for liberation, for freedom from suffering. Because sometimes when you read Theravada, it's very intellectual, first of all. And you can really get a lot of really neat ideas. And if Theravada Buddhism is left as just a kind of set of intellectual principles and ideas, then it's not really, it can remain at that level of thought. So one of the things I always try to emphasize is the teachings of the Buddha are for reflection, first of all. And reflection, I'll give you an example. I gave a talk last night at Bodhikusuma in Sydney. And I was speaking about self-sacrifice as a kind of consideration, as a theme. And the gentleman came up afterwards and said, well, yeah, okay, self-sacrifice, but you know those people that blow themselves up, they're doing self-sacrifice. And what I was trying to indicate to him, I'm not taking an absolute position on self-sacrifice. I'm asking you to reflect on what is self-sacrifice as a wholesome tendency in the human heart. And that's a reflective quality. So I give out an idea, yeah, and then that person took it with his critical mind. He said, and he started to think, yeah, self-sacrifice. But sometimes self-sacrifice isn't right. Yeah. So that was a kind of absolute position he was taking. But I was just saying, what is self-sacrifice in your practice? Where is that? And reflection is this capacity to take language. And internalize it and see its significance in your own mind. Like even like a Nietzsche, impermanence, right? And that's pretty basic Buddhist 101. And we'll all agree upon it, right? Sure, things change. But it doesn't take a Buddha to say that. I mean, any garden variety guru can say that. Things change. But to actually take a Nietzsche change and apply it to your own mind when you are worried or frightened or hate someone, to actually see this is changing, this feeling is changing, to have that kind of perspective of change is a contemplative exercise rather than a belief in impermanence. Reflection is very important to understand that. Otherwise you don't get Buddhism, you just stay in the head, just in thoughts and ideas and views and opinions. So reflection is like a mirror, like if I cut my face, let's say I'm shaving, I cut my face. To look at that cut, I need a mirror. And I look in the mirror and I say, ah, okay, and then I clean it up and I put a band-aid on. And it's the same with teaching. The teaching is like, it's like a mirror to your own life. So if I say to you, practice metta, let's say, metta bhavana, the practice of loving kindness, and you take it as a kind of absolute idea, then what do? You start to say, I have to love everyone. I must be someone who loves people. That's not reflection, that's inner tyranny. Thou shalt love everyone all the time. And then when you hate someone, you feel guilty. Right? Whereas reflection is like the Buddha suggested we practice compassion. So that when I read that, Metta Sutta, may all beings be well, and then I use that as a reflection, then when I begin to hate myself, or hate you, or hate my neighbor, or hate the possums, or whatever I hate, and I begin to say, oh, that's hatred. And the mirror helps me to see hatred. And as I see that hatred, I say, that's not the path. And I'm patient with it until it ceases. Whereas attachment to an idea, if you attach to the idea, like an ideal, if you attach to that, then you hate yourself for hating others. And you become self-critical and self-disparaging, and the whole project becomes very, very ugly, actually. See what I mean? Even reflection is a mirror, rather than just intellectual positions. I always find it interesting. I meet some of my friends in Ottawa from Sri Lanka, and they studied Buddhism in high school, and they studied the Four Noble Truths, right? And they got A's, probably A plus, the doctors and engineers, but they didn't have a clue how to use it. And the Four Noble Truths. But it was just an idea. Yeah, Buddhism says suffering, cause, end of suffering, path. Pass the exam, A plus, and then go back and suffer. Whereas reflection, yeah, what is that? It's like, there is suffering. So there's a mirror thing, oh, there is suffering. So where is that in my own mind? There is a cause, and so on. So this is very important to understand how to use intellect for wisdom rather than just have a position, a Buddhist position. Believing in Buddhism will not free you. It will make you a Buddhist. But it won't free you. Yeah? And you could argue your case, but it won't really free you. What frees you is the reflective, contemplative mind. So ideas are internalized, and internalization teaches you, and then that teaching brings you to insight and liberation. So like during this retreat, try to, and I'm sure you do this already, you use the same reminders you get all the time, but try to reflect on the way things are, first of all. Try to make conscious what you're actually experiencing, rather than just judge what you're experiencing, or try to get some kind of other experience. So the way I like to do that is I like to use sound, I like to use listening. Now, if you just do an exercise with me, those who are not fourth jhana yet, if you can do an exercise with me now, if you just listen. And to listen, you have to stop thinking. Yeah? Just listen. So, to listen, first of all, you have to stop thinking. Now listen and just let the sounds come to you. Or the silence come to you. Just listen, let the sounds come to you. Right. Now notice that mind. Now that's the mind where you're not trying to go anywhere, correct? You're not trying to become, you're not trying to get rid of, but you are present. Now, can you do that for 3 days? If you can, you'll be sitting up here tomorrow. that's it, isn't it? We're just trying to come to the present moment, awaken to the way things are, and be receptive to the way things are, and watch them changing. And that's really hard to do. You do it for what? 30 seconds, and you start to think about tomorrow, or you start to think, oh, my hips hurting, or I'm tired, I want to go to sleep, or what are we going to have for breakfast tomorrow? So to actually do that is to, I think to realize that isn't so far away, is it? Just listen. Stop thinking. You're there. But to sustain that kind of presence, that kind of awareness is a great challenge. And that's one good way to look at the meditation practice, where rather than trying to get something, you're remembering something. Rather than trying to acquire something, you're kind of letting go of the past and future and coming into the present moment. Now that's hard to do just on sound, so quite often we choose a meditation object. So we choose something like the breath, or metta, or body awareness, or whatever. But the principle is the same. So then you can take something like listen, you can bring your consciousness to that clarity, listen, and then focus it. Focus it on, say, the feeling of your hands. So take the feeling of your left hand and listen to your left hand as it will. Just feel your left hand. Feel the heat, pressure. And you have to stop thinking, right? And then apply that to the breath. So then take one in-breath, one out-breath. It's the same thing. And then do that for 4 hours. Right? Or do that with a walking meditation, or do that with the eating, whatever you do. But if you get that, I think if you get that principle, right, of what the awakened mind is, and just keep remembering that, rather than trying to become someone who's enlightened, which is probably difficult, to say the least, if you can remember what the awakened mind is, and make that really conscious, and make that important, and make that a valuable thing, and then try to remember that one breath at a time, one breath at a time, then the whole sense of me becoming something is no longer the project, it's more like awakening to the way things are. Now you can apply that principle to negative things as well. So if you're feeling bored, upset, disappointed, irritated, pain, yeah, you can also awaken to that. But that's harder to do. So if you start to feel your hips are killing you, you can certainly shift, right? But to actually just know, oh, just to listen to your hips hurting, that's more of a challenge. And my hips feel this way. But everyone knows in meditation, if I shift on every piece of discomfort I have, I'm going to be very restless. So then I learn to listen to discomfort. Discomfort feels this way. Just like you can listen to sound, that's neutral. Now I have discomfort. Discomfort feels this way. And try to hold the mind in that same way of receptive awareness. And there you start to develop strength, right? Because it's not fulfilling your desires. The discomfort is against your desire pattern. Right? And there you're challenged, but there you develop strength. Your hip starts to hurt, so your knee starts to hurt, your back starts to hurt. Not in a way where you harm yourself, move when you want, but you begin to just be present to the unpleasant, aware of the unpleasant. The unpleasant feels this way. And that begins to develop what we call paramitas, patience, endurance, determination, wisdom. And so quite often sitting that has a lot of discomfort in it can lead to a lot of peace. Not necessarily, but if you develop the paramitas in that way, the sense of being present. But to me, I think the most important idea I would like to offer this evening is just awaken. You know? What does it mean to awaken the mind? And sustain that awake mind. You know? And notice there's no desire in that. You're not trying to get rid of what you're experiencing. You're not trying to become anything else. And it's not intellectual. It's not a piece of intellectual information analysis. It's a bright, radiant presence. Any questions around those kinds of ideas? I'll hammer away at that all weekend, so we get a second chance.
What about shifting the mind from the pain? Shifting the...
Sure, yeah. Okay, so the question is, what about shifting the mind from the pain? If you... whatever effort you make, if your effort is coming from the awake mind, then you can do all kinds of things. First thing, you have to awake the mind. If you're awake to the pain, and then you shift to something else from non-aversion, from clarity, then it's an interesting experiment, because you're still mindful, right? So I shift to a place which doesn't have as much pain, or I move, or whatever. But if you're shifting comes from aversion to pain, then what you're doing is your intention is from aversion, which makes you restless. Right? So the main point is to apply your attention from clarity rather than from desire. Yeah? So there's no absolute about where you put your attention or how you put your attention, but if you don't get the mind to that awake state, and you're kind of reactive, then you stay very restless. But if you bring your mind to that awake state, then you just try things, make it an experiment, like what it would feel like if I brought my attention to some other part of the body, then it's interesting, and then you see the result. But if you're doing it from the desire to get rid of, that'll keep you restless. And that's one of the big lessons, how to pay attention from non-desire, rather than from desire. Yeah. Yes.
What do you do when you become mindful, but then you get overwhelming, say, negative, but it's a feeling that kind of overwhelms you,
uh-huh.
And you get more caught up in the feelings than you don't really care about mindfulness. You just want to move out of.
Then I would suggest you use body awareness, because there's kind of many aspects of developing this path. One is the aspect of purification. One is the aspect of just developing the capacity to do samadhi practices. One is the aspect of developing virtuous qualities. So combine purification and virtuous qualities. So let's say I had a terrible divorce 2 years ago. Not true, I haven't been married. Say 2 years ago I had the most acrimonious, bitter, awful, went to the courts, lawyers got all the money, divorce. And I kind of work it through, and then I want a retreat, and something triggers off this whole emotional memory. And that's very common, isn't it? So first of all, because we are emotional beings, we have memories. Our memories are quite often imbued with emotion. They're not just storylines. So when that emotion comes up, it's very, very unpleasant. But it is natural. There's nothing wrong with it. It's natural. And my task then is, how can I process this without repressing it, and without indulging it. Now the narrative or storyline that comes up with the memory of the divorce is, you know, I'll never ever forgive that person, it was unfair, or I should forgive them, and then the mind just begins to think. So what I try to do is, when if something powerful comes up, I recognize the symptom, the thoughts are a symptom of something in here. And I just try to redirect my attention to my heart or my guts, good simple, and just feel what this memory like is like in the body. Now if you can sustain that attention, and the story comes up and you have to keep repeating that, if you can sustain that attention in the body, then you start to practice purification. In other words, the energy now that is coming up, you're no longer feeding it. You're no longer giving it nutrient. And because you're no longer feeding it, its energy has a kind of karmic momentum which you have to bear witness to. But as it goes through you, the tendency for it to fool you, and the tendency for it to repeat itself in the same volume, lessens. If, however, you feed it with thought, you tend to recreate the kind of reality, me and him, or me and her, or whatever it is. So body awareness is crucial to purification. Take something even more deep. Let's say if someone has child abuse, and then that comes up, it's even more difficult, but it's the same principle. So then taking it in the body, you can also then start to direct your mind into thoughts of, may I be free from this? May I be free from fear? So you kind of gently, you know, keep with suggestions to your heart. Yeah. And that purification part also develops paramita, you develop patience and compassion. So a retreat, if you experience these strong things, it can be a very difficult retreat, but very liberates you from that. And my own experience of that was I've suffered a lot from fear in my life. As a kid, I used to be afraid of telephones. The telephone would ring and I'd run to another room. And so where that fear comes from, I don't know. But certainly as I began to meditate, it was like a terrible, terrible, gut-wrenching, kind of anxious, panicky, awful, awful kind of state of mind. And everything in me wanted to just run away and hide. But there was no place to hide. And then as I began to see the problem with that upsurgence of energy was that it wasn't an upsurgence of it. It was me not wanting it. What we call vibhava tanha, the desire to get rid of. And when I began to see the desire to get rid of was the problem, not the fear. That took a long time. It's the desire to get rid of, not the fear, that I began to welcome it and let it be there. And then the purification could take place. But until, as long as I was struggling, I was analyzing it, trying to get rid of it, and, you know, doing everything except let it be there. And suddenly when I let it be there in this kind of listening way, just listen to fear, 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 then it began to process through me and it began to cease. Because I no longer had a desire to get rid of it. And that's through the body. So the body the body doesn't lie. Your thoughts are always lying. Have you noticed that? You know, your thinking mind can tell you all kinds of nonsense. Right? But your body is, you know, it's a kind of natural force that can really inform you. So the more you can practice body awareness, you get a kind of biofeedback going. Your emotions start to stir up because of what you know. Oh, yeah, wow, I feel that. And you go there, and it calms you. It takes courage, you know, if the emotional upheaval is very, very intense and deeply rooted in your psyche, it takes much courage. So you have to be very kind. I never suggest get in there and rip it out, you know, it's like if it's too heavy, go check out the kangaroos or whatever you do here, right? And if it's too strong, go for a walk, and do things gently, kindly. Because once these things are triggered, once you have awareness and things become conscious, they'll take care of themselves. So you don't have to get too intense about it. And then sometimes you're being gentle and having compassion for yourself and drinking more tea or whatever one does. But this is a very important part of spiritual life, purification. Very, very important part. And just to have the sense that awareness can take you through these things. And to have the kind of courage and trust to trust in that. Alright. Let's say 30, perhaps you're tired. I don't know. We can maybe close the meeting.
Arahaṁ sammā sambuddho bhagavā buddhaṁ bhagavatam nabhivādhemi. Svākato bhagavatā dhammo dhammaṁ namassāmi. Patipano bhagavato savaka sangho sangha namah.